to President Obama's speech a couple of weeks ago on the crisis. And welcome to the program, Dr. Berger.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Betsy.
I don't know how it is that we haven't had you on the show. I don't think we have yet. With all these books, I'm on your website. You are quite an expert. So thanks for joining us on rather short notice.
My pleasure.
And thank you for writing that great piece.
Thank you very much.
What prompted it?
I listened to Obama's climate plan, and as he presented it in his Georgetown University speech on June 26th, and I could not fail but to be struck by his good intentions. I think that it's a valiant effort to try and educate the public about climate change and about climate science denial and about the benefits of clean energy and energy efficiency. But there are some inherent contradictions in President Obama's all-of-the-above energy policy. And I felt that some of the media may have misunderstood or misinterpreted what President Obama was really doing in his speech. I felt that it has been recognized in some quarters as a very positive effort, and I think that it is. I think it's a step in the right direction. But at the same time, it is mostly a shift from one fossil fuel to the other, from coal to natural gas, with some relatively minor efforts from a financial standpoint to advance clean energy and energy efficiency. I think all of those efforts are laudable, but I think that it was a very modest, moderate, and of necessity for political reasons, a very restrained speech, and it didn't include any deep cuts in greenhouse gas emissions or any emergency measures. It didn't call for a carbon tax, for example. It didn't restrain coal exports, which can actually undermine U.S. climate policy by sending the coal that we don't burn to countries like China and India so that they can burn it, and we all have a common atmosphere, so that doesn't accomplish the goal of reducing carbon pollution.
What do you make of the argument that the reason he did not call for a carbon tax is that he knows that if he does so, the psychology in the Republican Party of opposing anything that Obama proposes would lead Republicans to reject it, even though it's an idea that was that has been embraced by conservative economists?
Well, I think that's absolutely correct, and that President Obama's hands are essentially tied by an obstructionist Republican Congress, and specifically the Republicans in the House. So halfway measures are better than no measures at all. I think he's doing what he can, although it's a very belated effort. He's now using the power of the executive branch to implement some clean energy and energy efficient measures and doing some carbon switching from coal to natural gas. But it's something that he could have done during the first 6 years of his administration, and I somewhat wonder where has he been, and I think that he's been too deferential to the coal lobby and has moved a little bit slower than I would like on the issue of climate change.
We couldn't agree with you more, and given that your latest book is entitled Climate Myths, The Campaign Against Climate Science, how much credit, quote, do you give to the denial machine?
Well, I think the denial machine has really been responsible for causing a stalemate on the national, on the congressional front with respect to climate policy, and that has also tied us up internationally because we could not point in international negotiations to major climate policy achievements at home. Other countries could turn around and say, well, you go first, and since we were basically thwarted by the coal and fossil fuel lobby, we have not really passed legislation like the Waxman-Markey bill, which was considered in Congress during Obama's first term, and he did not fight very vigorously for it. He also did not establish a very strong presence or a strong negotiating stance for the United States at the 2009 Copenhagen climate talks or the subsequent talks at Doha in Qatar.
You mentioned the Waxman-Markey bill. Do you agree with Jill Romo's book, the Climate Progress website, that Obama's mistake in his first term was to prioritize the passage of the health care bill over the Waxman-Markey bill, and also that what he should have done is that not only should he have pressed for the passage of Waxman-Markey first, but he should have used reconciliation to ensure that it passed in the Senate instead of ending up with the situation we had where it basically died in the Senate?
Well, as a climate guy, I definitely would have liked to have seen him prioritize climate change in his first term when he had much more political capital than he has today. And there are some analysts who feel that he essentially gave away some of his most important negotiating chips to the fossil fuel lobby in the first term. And basically climbed on board the all-of-the-above energy policy train and began to allow a free-for-all of drilling on public lands. That's something that, if he were going to do it, he could have demanded some important climate change concessions in return. Similarly, for reasons that I totally don't understand, the administration has provided over $8 billion in federal loan guarantees to a nuclear power plant construction effort going on in Georgia, which would not survive on its economic merits. And I simply don't understand why the administration is moving in that direction when there are much more cost-effective ways of reducing carbon emissions than building extraordinarily expensive nuclear power plants that have tremendous problems of every sort, including huge cost overruns, and have a very deleterious impact on consumers' utility bills.
Hmm. And speaking of controversial energy sources, wondered what you think about the natural gas boom. And speaking of booms, you know, with the train derailment up in Canada, and you know, more than a dozen people's lives have been lost, and perhaps even higher death toll. It shows the, you know, environmental and health costs, human lives cost of transporting oil from the tar sands is what we're going to see with the problem with the pipeline. And some people say, well, this train derailment is a sign that we need the pipeline. And, of course, the pipeline opponents would say, no, we need neither. We need to go to renewable sources like solar and wind. If we could just get your quick take on both the Keystone Pipeline and fracking.
My goodness, you've put so many questions on the table. Good points. But let me just break off a small piece of that and address the question of natural gas. And in theory, natural gas is much better than coal because under perfect conditions, it emits about half as much carbon pollution to produce a kilowatt hour from natural gas than from coal. The trouble is that when you're using fracked gas, there's a significant amount of leakage in the fracking operations. And I've done some very rough calculations that show that if you assume a 7% leakage rate from fracked wells, then fracked natural gas is at least 25% worse for the atmosphere and the environment than coal on a long-term basis, just in terms of the carbon pollution that's emitted during those operations and looking at the whole life cycle of natural gas and coal. So arguably, we're not getting an advantage by shifting from coal to fracked natural gas. That's a major problem. And in terms of your question about the Keystone Pipeline, there are about 315 billion barrels of oil in the Athabasca tar sands. It's the dirtiest energy that there is on the planet. And it would certainly sabotage all reasonable efforts to control carbon pollution if we begin exploiting those resources in a big way, and the Keystone Pipeline obviously would facilitate that. Incidentally, there are other major dangerous energy deposits around the world, like the Orinoco River Basin heavy crude oil, and there are some estimates that 513 billion barrels of it exist, and these are deposits which, were we to exploit them and convert all that carbon to CO2, would thoroughly destroy the climate that we have today and send us pell-mell into a very dystopic climate future.
What did you make of President Obama's reference to the divestment movement? The New York Times picked up on that, and some of the opponents of the divestment movement, like National Review, of course, also picked up on it. Do you think that will sort of, you know, add some juice to Bill McKibben's efforts to get people to divest from holdings in fossil fuel companies?
You know, I'm not familiar with the specific remark that President Obama made about the divestment movement, but in general, I think that divestment is a good idea, and I think that if you don't like a policy, the first thing you can do is stop paying for it and stop encouraging it. So I'm in favor of that on general principles.
I think you said something like we need to invest and divest. It almost seemed like kind of an off-the-cuff, you know, remark that he slipped in there. Be interesting to know if it was scripted or not.
I really don't have any insight to offer on that. But
well,
I think that it does highlight a kind of a larger point, that there are some contradictory elements in President Obama's speech. I think that while he has good intentions and did a lot to advance the dialogue on climate change, and he has come out squarely in favor of climate science and squarely against climate science denial. And if nothing else, I'm extraordinarily grateful to him for doing so. But I think the fact that there are these contradictory elements in his speech and plan, he, on the one hand, he says we have a moral obligation to deal with this critical threat to our lives and livelihoods and homes and businesses, and we're already experiencing hundreds of billions of dollars from damages that are caused by climate change. And then the measures that are produced are rather equivocal and somewhat palliative, but not really decisive and commensurate with the hazard that he's pointing to.
And you addressed, you know, the political necessities he's facing, but obviously the scientific realities are in conflict with being politically correct.
Well, it's not only that, Betsy. Pardon my interrupting, but what I'm trying to say is that this plan, at best, brings us back in carbon pollution to about where we were in 1990, when we were already the world's largest carbon polluter. And that in itself is not really good enough, given what we now have learned in the last 25 years about the risks of climate change. And that's why I describe climate change as an unheralded emergency. And we need to start treating it as an emergency and taking measures that have a chance to prevent the kind of almost grotesque climate change that we're heading towards within the next few decades. There are some projections that show that on the current emissions course, the current carbon pollution rates, we are heading towards temperature increases of 7 to 11 degrees. Some say by 2100, there are some estimates out more recently indicating that we might be heading toward that in 2060 or 2080. And this would be a global catastrophe of unknown, unprecedented magnitude during human civilization and during humans' experience on the planet, in fact. And it would lead to the extinction of half of the species on Earth, and in 2100 under that kind of a scenario, we would find that at any given time about 30% of the world would be in drought. And today, at any given time, maybe 1% of the world's land area is in drought. If we're in conditions of widespread pervasive drought, there's going to be widespread starvation. There will be hundreds of millions of refugees on the move. And the planet, under those conditions, is not going to be able to support the 13 or 14 billion people who are projected to be alive at 2100. Even in 2050, if we start accelerating our emissions as we've been doing, and they increase by 58% globally from 1990 to 2012, we are going to see a situation where Africa is going to have even more trouble feeding itself and taking care of its people than it is now. There will be another billion Africans. And how are we going to take care of those people if the planet is in pervasive drought and we see huge climate impacts?
We could go on, and I know it was BR's turn for a question, but we're running out of time. I really just want to thank you for your incredible contribution, some 11 books on climate and energy issues. If you can be our favorite resource on these issues, and you're right in my own backyard in Berkeley, I would really appreciate it, because here we are in the middle of summer. I have to say I'm up at Lake Tahoe on vacation this week, and I've been up here every summer most of my life, and I've never seen temperatures in the 90s, you know, in late June, early July already. And there's, you know, smoke from a not-so-distant fire in Carson, Nevada. You know, mm-hmm. So it's real. It's here. And one wonders what it's going to take to wake up the American people to smell the carbon.
I couldn't agree with you more. And thank you very much, Betsy, for giving me the opportunity to talk with you and your listeners.
Well, thank you. And thank you, DR, for finding that fabulous column. We've been speaking with Dr. John J. Berger, and we'll be speaking with him again. His website, I recommend, is at johnjberger.com. He speaks and writes on climate, energy, climate change, energy, and natural resources. When we come back after this short break, you're going to want to stay tuned. We're going to be interviewing a couple with a documentary they've been working on for quite some time on the environmental impacts of war and preparations for war, something that's really not been focused on too much and something we haven't really talked about on the show. So stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Greenfront.